as I think I've said a few times, it's always a pleasure to come to St Paul's Terrey Hills. Actually, it's a privilege. You're very kind to me for anyone who ever invites me to come. So thank you very much. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, teach us the truth from your word and shine the light of your spirit on in our own hearts, that we might know ourselves as we really are, and then enable us by that same spirit to live lives that are more in accordance with your wishes, that better reflect your character. So help us in that regard this day and this week. Amen. Well, if you're interested in cricket, and I realise that some of you are not, and sometimes that gets people annoyed, but Australia defeated South Africa in the first test. And if you're a South African, that'll not be very pleasing. I'm not sure if we do have many South Africans here this morning. Our relationships with South Africans generally are pretty good. They're a bit more testy when it comes to New Zealanders. And if there are New Zealanders here, then take no offence at anything I'm about to say. I lived for 6 months in New Zealand some years ago, and to begin with, I was on my own, and I lived in a student sort of a hostel. The dean of students, who was a senior student, I became fairly friendly with, and we played a lot of squash. The time came, however, for me to leave the student hostel, and I really had to say my goodbyes to this particular dean. He didn't know I was an Australian, but it worried him a little. And on this last occasion, he said to me, "Where do you come from, really?" Now, there were some difficulties with the French at the time and with the Americans, and so I began by saying, "Well, I'm not an American, and I'm not a Frenchman." And at this point, he said, "Oh, no." He didn't even let me finish. He was very serious. He said, "You're an Australian." "I hate Australians." And he was deadly serious. I only met him, I think, on one further occasion. Our relationship wasn't as good as it had been earlier. Why is it that we do hate sometimes? And some of us, when we were asked, "Have we ever said to someone, 'I hate you'?" Some of us put our hands up. Look, this could degenerate into a bit of psychology, and we could talk about why we sometimes get so angry, even if we don't say the words, "I hate you." The hatred is deep inside. And sometimes that occurs with people who are the closest to us. It's the ones that we have to relate to, you know, face to face. They're the ones that we sometimes get most angry with. Well, we could talk a bit about psychology, but I think we ought to try and focus on what Jesus said. He's very, very clever. He's very, very cunning. Very, very purposeful. He begins this famous Sermon on the Mount really talking about himself, well, pretty close to the beginning. And he makes this extraordinary statement, which theologians have had difficulty coming to grips with. Exactly what did he have in mind? "I have not come to abolish the law or the prophets, but I have come to fulfil them." What exactly did he mean by that? I'm not sure whether we're going to have anything on the PowerPoint. That's probably good if we don't. I don't know if you... Nasty relationships. Yeah, I couldn't think of something which covered both elements of what we read from the New Testament. It's pretty weak, actually, talking about nasty relationships, but nasty relationships it is. We do need to look at this idea that... this thing that Jesus expressed when he said, "I've come to fulfil the law." What exactly did he mean? Now, I think we're tempted, and understandably, to think that when Jesus said, "I've come to fulfil the law," that in fact he meant something like, "In my death, I've paid for the sins which we're all tarnished with, and the law finds its fulfilment in righteousness, in my actually paying the penalty for the sins of mankind." I think that's understandable that we should think like that. I'm not sure that that was really uppermost in Jesus' mind when he said, "I have not come to abolish but to fulfil." I think what you actually find as Jesus' fulfilment is the teaching that follows. you actually find Jesus fulfilling the law in the things that he said in chapters 5, 6 and 7 and so on. They're very disturbing chapters because they seem to demand so much. But I think that's what Jesus was getting at when he said, I've come to fulfill the law. He's pointing to what the law points to. The law doesn't say it itself, the Old Testament law, the Jewish law, doesn't say these sorts of things that he's about to say. I think what he's saying is, but this is their ultimate reference. This is where they go. Now, understandably, if you were a disciple or a member of the crowd and you were listening to the things that Jesus said on this occasion, as it went on and on and on, I could imagine anyone saying, well, it looks like living under the rule of God, living the way that God would want you to live, it's impossible. And that's got to be the truth of it, hasn't it? To live the life that was only ever the recipient of God's approval. Not possible. But God never talks in terms of try hard. He never says to us, do your best. Being God, only the absolute ideal will be sufficient. And so Jesus, in the little passage we've read, deals with the whole business of where does murder point? You shall not murder. Now, we ought to be a little careful about what Jesus is not saying. It's fairly clear if you look at the Old Testament law, and we had the Ten Commandments read to us, that killing itself sometimes occurred and a person was not culpable. It occurred in battle. It occurred as a consequence of a legal judgment. When a policeman today in the line of duty kills a person, he should not feel that somehow that Jesus had words directed towards him or a soldier in battle. Although I understand in historically, and maybe it might be your position, that some people have said, look, going to war is wrong. Killing under any circumstances is wrong. I'm just trying to say in the Old Testament that was not the case. And I think that particular commandment really has to do with unjustified, improper taking of someone else's life. So I think Jesus is not saying you shall not kill, that there shall be no killing. Furthermore, when it comes to anger, because that's something that comes up in the little passage, I don't think Jesus is actually saying you shall never get angry. But he's not going to, by the way, go through all these modifications beforehand and let us try and escape. For instance, Jesus himself, and you might say, well, that's Jesus, he's entitled to, but Jesus himself got angry, very, very angry. Remember at the towards the end, just before he died, he was very angry with the money changers in the temple. Early in Mark's Gospel, I think it's Mark chapter 3, it says he was very angry with the people who were testing him to see whether he would heal a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath. Very angry with them. A friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, a clergyman, a very, very good bloke, was not present at a particular meeting that the diocese held, at which something occurred, and he became familiar with it, and we talked about it. And he said to me, Barry, he said, I'm angry at what occurred. Now, I was a bit angry at what occurred, but he felt it more. He said, if I'd have been there, he said, I'd have spoken up. So some anger is legitimate, and I don't think Jesus is actually saying that there's no place for anger. But again, he's not going to sort of say, oh, look, I want you to understand me correctly. I'm not saying that all killing is wrong, or I'm not saying that all anger is wrong. Jesus wants to get at the heart of the matter, the things that really count, the way we really think. And so, what sort of things did he say? Well, he began by saying what the law actually said, but he said it in a rather peculiar way, didn't he? You know, you've heard it said, or people have said in the past, that you shall not murder. It's an interesting way, isn't it, to put it? I think what he's doing is he's saying, look, that is the law. But I'm interested in how you've thought about it, how it's lived with you. What does it mean in the back of your mind? I think that's what he's getting at. And he phrases about six of these somewhat similarly, six of these sorts of things. So this one we're just dealing with anger and something else, nastiness. So that's an interesting introduction. And then what did he actually say after that? The anger of anyone and the consequences. Now, in fact, there are three little bits that Jesus puts before us, puts before the crowd. And the experts differ as to exactly what is he doing here. The first one has to do with anger. The second one has to do with calling someone racha. Could anyone just indicate to me, if it was not embarrassing to you, could you put your hand up and tell me the last time you called someone racha? Just wondering? No. Like, it's an Aramaic word, it transliterated, and it's pretty insulting, probably means something like, you imbecile, you idiot. And then the third one, he says, you know, if anyone calls someone a fool, we'll get to these three pretty quickly. And then there are consequences. Anyone who, in fact, and let's just check on the text, I tell you, anyone who is angry with his brother, someone pretty close in mind, because that's normally where the anger goes, will be subject to judgment. Well, what is interesting in our world and what's interesting in the Jewish world is that nobody with anger was ever subject to judgment. How can you judge someone's anger? Like, you might say to me, I was very angry. Well, then I've got to work out, someone's got to work out, why were you angry? What was the anger? Oh, are you telling a lie? You might be telling fibs. You might like me to think that you were angry when you weren't at all. I mean, it's very difficult to make a judgment on anger. And then the second one, I think we ought to deal with the three as they go. The second one, he says, if you call, anyone who says to his brother, racha, is answerable to the Sanhedrin or to the council. It's just the word for council. And it could mean the Jewish Sanhedrin of the day. We'll get to that in a moment. And then the third one, but anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire in hell. The fire in Gehenna. Gehenna was a rubbish tip. Filth and rubbish was burnt, probably still in the days of Jesus, and it was to the south of Jerusalem, and the smoke would rise and the odour would rise. It was a filthy place, but undoubtedly it's a reference to hell. So when you look at those three things, anger, calling someone racha, and then calling someone fool, and looking at the three consequences, subject to judgment, subject to the council. By the way, subject to has got the idea of there's a good chance of, and the consequences following. And the third one, the dangers of the fire of hell, Gehenna, God's ultimate rubbish tip. When you look at those three, this is where the experts differ. When you look at the consequences, looks like the consequences get worse and worse, doesn't it? You know, judgment, counsel. Maybe God's counsel could be in mind. God's sort of judgment seat. And then, bang, the actual fires of hell. By the way, pretty serious stuff. But it is indeed only God who could bring about judgment. See, we can't. We don't know what's going on in people's heads. But God does. Maybe, and this is just a Newman idea, so, you know, take it any way you like, maybe they've all got to do with God in mind. That in fact they're all fairly serious. Not just subject to someone else's judgment, but God's judgment in our anger. Improper anger. Not just any old council that might happen to say, come on, Newman, you've got to answer to this. Standing committee of the diocese. Well, I hope they never do that to me. Calls upon you. Justify yourself, what you did. Calling someone racha. And then the fires of hell, maybe they've all got to do with God's judgment. Maybe, you see, I think Jesus is very, very clever. And he, in a sense, he plays purposefully with the ears of his hearers. Do you understand what I'm saying? And one of the difficulties with that idea that somehow or other things are getting worse, and that's one possibility, is that, yeah, but the offence looks to be the same. Anger, calling someone racha, you idiot, you imbecile, calling someone a fool. Maybe the order of those, and again this is just a Newman idea, maybe the order of those is in the reverse. See, anger is what is real. It's real. It belongs to us. The anger that's associated with hatred. Still having that little bit of Aramaic stuff stuck in the middle suggests to me that, yes, it was a technical sort of expression worth putting in, meaning something like, you imbecile, you idiot. Now, the other day on the radio, I heard someone talking about something which had happened during the week, and the fellow said, you imbecile, speaking about someone who did something. Don't you realise, blah, blah, blah? I don't think there was any anger in it, by the way. I think it was an appropriate comment. You imbecile. But maybe what's happening here is that, in fact, there is a sense in which they're slightly getting less, although they're much the same. You fool seems to us to be pretty ordinary. You fool. Well, we do foolish things, and sometimes we deserve to be called, I think, fools or acting in a foolhardy manner. But I think in the end, Jesus is saying this. Anyone who wants to live under God's rule, you must consider what God's rule will ultimately mean. Don't look at the law as though that's the final and the end bit in terms of the way you've understood the law. See where it points. Anger is a terrible thing. I was living on an island with my wife for about 3 months, an island community, last year. The island numbers vary from 300 in a non-tourist part of the time to about 1,000, say, when the tourists are there. Many of the people who live on the island are related to someone else on the island. Strong connections. There's a fellow there, he's a bit older than myself, and we really have become fairly good friends, but to begin with he was a bit anti, certainly not interested in coming along to a function like this, and he's expressed that to me very clearly. There's no way you're getting me to church. And nonetheless, as our friendship has developed, he's found it possible to be quite frank with me about a number of things, about a number of people on the island. In fact, there was a lady that invited myself and my wife to her to have dinner with her one night, probably only because we'd been there for 3 months and she felt that she was appropriate. And in this dinner conversation, every now and again, she'd say, I'm bringing down the cone of silence. Now, if you're familiar with that, it means this is secretive, this is within ourselves. And then she would tell us about some scandal on the island. So there are hatreds on the island. And this fellow that I was referring to originally, he said to me, tell me a story about a relation of his whom he used to mow the lawn for. And he said, on one occasion, he said, I was mowing the lawn, and she came out and displayed her anger about the way I was mowing it. Well, he said, I stopped the mower, I walked off, and we never spoke to each other for the next 10 years. That's anger that's degenerated so awfully. They lived on the island. They were related. They bumped into each other. They couldn't avoid it. He was waiting for her to apologise. She was probably waiting for him to apologise. I have no idea. That serious? It's more serious to be subject to the judgment of God, to be in his council chambers, and to have hell knocking at the door. We must deal with that anger which is rooted in hatred. We must deal with it seriously. These are serious warnings. Okay, the second part of this little bit that Jesus
had to say is not so much our having anger, but it still has to do with us. And it's linked actually in the Greek with the word therefore. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift to God.
Now, this is a strange connection, I think, with this therefore. We've been talking about being angry, having hatred towards other people, treating them in a despicable manner. And suddenly, Jesus says, therefore, not you having a problem with someone else, but your brother has something against you. You better deal with it. Now, I remember talking to a lady, I think it was 2 weeks ago, in St. Ives Church, and I've forgotten how the conversation arose, but I said, I think speaking about someone else, you know, maybe she or he found it possible to say, I was wrong. And the lady said to me, oh, Barry, that's very difficult to say. It's very difficult to say I was wrong. It is. Some of us actually more difficult than others. Again, we could talk a bit about psychology about how we were brought up and what influence it has. But here is a situation where Jesus is saying, look, this is all about you. In the first instance, about your anger. And in the second instance, it's about your wrong that you are guilty of with respect to some other person. You're responsible for it. Now, my mother, and she only had one sister-in-law, my auntie, and I actually do not know what happened, but when they were in their 50s or thereabouts, they had a barney, they had an argument. And they never spoke to each other for many years. One of her sons, the only one that's living, was just speaking to me a few months ago, and he said, Barry, whatever happened in that past, wasn't it good that in the end they reconciled to each other? And as older ladies and as widows, they did a bit of travelling overseas and they became very good friends. What a pity for so many years they fell out with each other for whatever reason, whoever was wrong. Sometimes, by the way, it is difficult to work out who was wrong and very difficult for yourself to work out whether you were wrong or not. Oh, Barry, it's very hard to say I was wrong. And after a while, it becomes very, very difficult, and sometimes, I guess, in the course of events, it's so muddled, the best thing is to just be reconciled anyway. But my mum, because of this falling out with her only sister-in-law, never went and took communion for years because of this bad relationship she had with her sister-in-law. Some people, when they look at this verse, actually think it's all to do with Holy Communion. It's not. But my mum did, and I can understand exact her thinking. What she should have done, or what the other person should have done, or what they both should have done was, look, forget about whether you go to Holy Communion or not, but that's what Jesus is saying in a sense, something like this. Look, before you lay your gift before God, get right with the person with whom there's a problem. That's what they should have been doing. Not sort of hiding under some little law which said, well, you better get right with your neighbour before you get right with God in Holy Communion, whatever that meant. And in fact, because I'm not getting right with my neighbour, therefore I won't have Holy Communion. I mean, it was quite distorted thinking, but in a sense, I suppose, someone might say it was noble. But isn't it interesting? Before doing something for God, as it were, that's highly God-focused, get right with the other person. Solve the problem. Don't let it go on and on and on. It becomes more and more difficult. Even if you weren't in the wrong, try to bring about some order of reconciliation. It's what Jesus is telling us. You see, it's easy to do things which look like they're God-focused, like bringing a gift, bringing a sacrifice to an altar in the temple, going to Holy Communion. That's easy to do. what's not easy is being reconciled where there's been a problem. That's harder. That's harder. God says, Jesus says, sort that out first of all.
And then he has this other last interesting bit to it all. Settle matters quickly with your adversary. And the idea, I think, is he's saying you really are in the wrong. Maybe you owe money, maybe you've stolen or whatever. Who is taking you to court? Do it while you are still with him on the way at the last moment. It's an extraordinary thing to say. Why wouldn't you have said something like, do it quickly before he does take you to court? I think he's saying, look, the consequences can be so great even if it's the very last moment. You might think that if you go to court, you'll get away with it. But no, as you go to court, get the matter solved. Deal with it. Pay him the money or whatever you've done. Apologize. I believe there's a man who's tried to bring 50 court cases against other people and has now been forbidden to bring any cases before the law somewhere in Australia. Goodness me, what on earth that amounts to. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still with him on the way. Or, does not the Chappelle Corby thing with its terror, and you've seen some of that stuff on television, a lot of it is prior, of course, when she was arrested. It has this same awesome terror that Jesus is trying to build into this passage. Otherwise, what'll happen is, you'll go to the judge. Then the judge may hand you over to the officer. Then you may be thrown into prison. Didn't you see that in the Chappelle Corby stuff? She sits in the court. She hears the judge. The officers take her away. She's sobbing. And she's thrown into prison. Jesus says, fix it up before it ever gets to anything like that, because I tell you what, you will remain in prison until you pay the last penny. That is very, very much the day of Jesus. You owe money, you get thrown into the clink, and you will remain there until the debt has been repaid in absolute full. No early release. Now, do we think that Jesus was giving us some healthy advice about people who want to take us to court? My own suspicion is no. This is the very clever, clever Jesus. You'd better reconcile yourself with God and do so quickly, for ultimate judgment is absolutely unavoidable. My suspicion is that Jesus has got a double-barreled shotgun. We tend to only hear the first blast, but the second is the devastating one. You will not escape until you have paid the last penny, and how can you ever repay when in fact you're in jail? Whew, heavy are the words of Jesus, but living under the rule of God, living by the ideal, that's what God requires of us. Well, you got any comments or questions or ideas where we should go? David.
Barry, on that last question.
Yes.
We might say to ourselves, I'm reconciled to God, I'm a Christian. Do you think Jesus is digging deeper than that?
Oh, yes, I think he is. I think he's really saying, what is it like to live as a Christian person in God's, under God's rule in this world? I mean, I think my own view is that it is a double-loaded shotgun, that there is it's very healthy, helpful advice on how to live, and that's ongoing. So if you find yourself, if anyone's, you know, here today finds themselves in a bad relationship with someone else, it may, of course, it takes two to tango, and it may be not possible for that reconciliation to occur because the other person's not willing. But you give it your best shot under God. You ask for his wisdom and assistance. So there is an ongoing living bit, but there is a final bit. And Christians ought not to imagine somehow or other that I'm reconciled to God, I'm like, I can do what I like. That's a dangerous position to take. One never knows what the future might hold under those circumstances. Got any other curly ones to throw? I'm not a New Zealander, by the way, or a South African, but and it wouldn't matter if I was. Yes. Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I actually thought it referred to the fact that God set down the law and none of us could keep it.
Yes. Yes.
But the way Jesus came, he actually lived life.
Yes.
So that he could be the perfect sacrifice.
Yes.
Otherwise, he wouldn't be worthy to die. Is that as well part of it, as well as the whole teaching of wanting to teach him and tell us what he means?
Yes, look, I think. That's look, the position that has been, you know, that you've espoused there is that Jesus fulfills the law and he himself lives the perfect life. So I should have introduced that as a possibility, you know, as something to think about at the beginning as well. Jesus lives the perfect life. He fulfills the law. So the three things that I've now produced, or we've now produced, is one, Jesus is pointing to what the law points to. He fulfills the law himself by being the perfect righteous one. And allied to that, he fulfills the law by paying the penalty that is due to us, so that the law is fulfilled for us. Now, if you look at the experts, I'm no expert, then you'll find people talking about those three things, one or more. My own view is that when you have this little discussion at the beginning of towards the beginning of chapter 5, where Jesus says, I've not come to abolish the law and the prophets, I've come to fulfil them. He then talks about, look, not one jot, not one tittle shall part from the law until all of his will fulfilled. And then at the end, towards the end, before he starts talking about the three different sorts of responses, when he's got to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, he says, loving your neighbour as yourself is the fulfilment of the law. I really think that it's like you've got two brackets, and that what you're seeing in the middle is that's the law in its fulfilment. So while the other two, the one that you've mentioned and the other one that I'd mentioned earlier, are perfectly understandable and may be correct, my own view is that you have Jesus fulfilling the law for what it is by saying, look, sorry, none of it gets done away with. But look at what it is, ultimately, out there. So that's my own view, that you actually have him fulfilling the law in his teaching, that he brings it to its fulfilment. But look, experts will differ on that, and I'm no expert, so I shouldn't even raise it. Yes, David?
Just comment on that. I think from the beginning of chapter 5, Jesus is explaining to the disciples what it means to be, as I call it, a citizen.
Yes,
of the
yes.
Kingdom.
Yep.
To a new life, where their righteousness is better than that of the scribes.
Yes, yes, he says, unless your unless your righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees and the scribes. And you can imagine the saying, well, wow. So I think that's where its emphasis is. But look, that's a go. One more possible? Yes. Now you were listening. Yes, yes.
Because it has been put to me that it is never, ever appropriate to call somebody cruel.
Yes.
My view is, and yes. Please disagree with me.
I see a little cross around your neck, so I'm going to be very hard pressed to disagree with you. Go ahead.
that in this instance, yes, it is inappropriate because it's the attitude toward behind what you're saying. Call somebody cruel in anger. A deliberate attempt to insult them, belittle them, that is inappropriate. However, in other places in the Bible says, the fool says in his heart there is no God.
Yes.
And in a few of the Proverbs, I can't remember exactly which ones they are, but certainly the Proverbs talks about the things that a fool does.
Yes.
So my view is, if sometimes it may be appropriate to call somebody a fool if they are acting in a way that is disregarding God, is acting in a way that sort of is like what they say in Proverbs, but not in a way to do them any harm, but maybe
yes.
a wake-up call.
Yes,
say, you know,
yes.
It's a means of saying, this is how God sees you, because you are acting in a way that is not taking him into account at all.
Yep.
So it's not really the word, it's more the attitude towards behind it.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's the problem with the text, that you, if you want to go to the text and sort of talk about, oh, but sometimes, that's okay, and that's what we're doing, and we will clarify that in a moment again. I think we'll say exactly what you're saying. Jesus is not going to sort of talk at great length with all the modifications, because he wants us to see how awful hatred is, because I think it's the hatred that lies behind the first three that he talks about, the racha, the fool, the anger. Jesus himself spoke to the scribes and the Pharisees on one occasion, recorded in Matthew 23, I think it is. Oh, you blind, you fools. And it's appropriate, for instance, for some time, without bringing hurt, for instance, to someone who is intellectually highly challenged, without making any slur on them as people at all, to say to someone else, you're an idiot. That is the most stupid thing you could ever do. Come on, wake up, son. So I'm looking at someone, but I didn't mean to. You're a fool to have done that. Very, very foolish. And then you'll fill in, adjectives and whatever. No, you're absolutely right. That it's an appropriate, there is appropriate times for someone being called a fool, to make them wake up, for someone being called an imbecile, for you to be angry. The point is here, Jesus is not, I'm not talking about those things, see, but it's good for us to get them straight so we do know what he's talking about. What he's talking about is where this is completely unjustified, inappropriate, but which is part of our life. Every now and again, something happens and we hate. And with that hatred is anger, or with that hatred are awful words. Words that really should never have been uttered. And that's what Jesus in the end is getting at. But I couldn't agree with you more. Okay. Oh, sorry. Yes. I think it's Sunday school time.
Yeah, probably. On that issue, I think one of the possible readings of the passage we had, I think, was that brothers and sisters could be inclusive of the brothers and sisters in Christ.
Yes.
And I went through an argument that suggested that in that case they have the Spirit of God in them, and therefore they can't be fooled in the sense of empty-headed.
I see.
In Psalm 14, where it says the fool said he's in his heart, there is
yes,
no God,
yes.
It's completely appropriate because
yes.
they don't have the Spirit
yes,
of God.
Yes, 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 yes. Look,
it's a bit of a side issue.
I understand. So what is being said here is that what you're indicating that some Christians might think is, oh, look, Christians should never call other Christians fools because they can't be fools because they have the Spirit of God and so on. I just think that's being Middle Ages arguing. I'm sorry, I think it belongs to the Middle Ages. And, Christian people can be as foolish as anyone, and a non-Christian person mightn't be as foolish in the same circumstances, or idiotic, or whatever. It's interesting that you raised the matter of brothers. It's I think the first two do refer to brothers, the third one in that first bit do not. Now, brothers for a Jewish person meant a fellow Jew, and I think what is happening here is that he may well have wanted to talk about your relationship, your attitude towards Gentiles and Samaritans and so on, but let's bring it to home. These are disciples who are living in a Jewish world, and I suspect it's saying, look, people who are close to you, fellow Jews, people that you think are, you're all New Zealanders or you're all South Africans, you're all, or whatever, look, within your world, because that's where it's going to strike the hardest, there is no room for this hatred. I think that's ultimately it. Okay. Thank you very much for your patience. Gosh, won't ask me again.